Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you in understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath. Hi, welcome back for another episode of the Keto Naturopath. I'm Dr. Carl Goldkamp. Today, I want to make an exception to what I've the prequel, the intro to the last 3.5 years, pretty much, and tell you about the extraordinary opportunity that's beginning right now. Actually, it's not an opportunity. It's an opportunity to listen to a very special interview. I had the good fortune to interview and talk to at length, actually twice. The one was recorded and one wasn't, but this is the recorded version, of course. With Dr. Artemis Sinopoulos, a wonderful name in any culture. I just love both how it's spelled for a dyslexic person and how it sounds. But Dr. Sinopoulos has really been the foundation of all we know about essential fatty acids. That's quite a big attribute to make to somebody like that. She would probably deny it, and I would say it's well-earned. But beyond that, she has been the one who has really talked about the omega-6-3 ratio and how we as a culture, now I'm speaking in the United States, Canada's probably not far behind us and Europe is not probably far behind us, with the 6-3 ratio and how it's extraordinarily drifted away to very dangerous ratios. In other words, about 100 years ago, we were 1-to-1. You know, if I took your blood and said, hey, what's your omega-3-6 ratio? It'd be about 1-to-1. Well, now, for an average person that knows nothing about health, it would probably be 20-to-1, 20 times the amount of omega-6 in your blood, should you be that person, to omega-3. And what difference does that make? Well, she's been talking about this since really the late 70s, and we'll get into that in a second. What she brought forward was why we need to look at that as a clinical laboratory analysis. We need to bring that into the conversation. Just like you go to your local doctor and he says, oh, your cholesterol's too high. You know, it's over 200. We should put you on a statin. Apart from my cholesterol issues, which is not this particular topic, though it actually is related, she brought into... And that's called the lipid panel when they look at the cholesterol. It's called the lipid panel. So you do, you know, total cholesterol, HDL, LDL, triglycerides, and that's pretty much it. And then you can get fancier if you want to add on any other tests like the, you know, the particles and so on and so forth. But she now brought in the Omega panel, and that's what it's called. And so whether you get it done at Quest or LabCorp, through your doctor, it actually gets done at a Cleveland hospital. They've kind of made it their thing, the 6-3 ratio. And in that, as a subset of that panel, is called the omega index, omega-3 index. And so those two have been outstandingly valuable in terms of determining your health and correlations of things that you can do. So this is actionable information of things that you can do. So it's not just esoteric, oh, I got this, I got that, what should I do? This is about something you can take action into 30 minutes, 30 seconds after you get that report about changing that ratio. So I've certainly have been focusing on that for my career for the last 20 years. And now been on YouTube about that and looking at lab values. We're talking about lab values, not like, oh, hey, you should have more of this and you should have more of that. That's true. If that you're at that level of maybe do this and maybe do that, then fine, go with that kind of information. I'm at the clinical level by saying omega-6, omega-3, omega-3 index. Let's look at these things, linoleic acid, arachidonic acid, and omega-3. EPA, DHA, and what sense does that make? It makes a big deal. You hear various people out there that are being promoted by other people want to claim part of that fame. She did the work. She did over 365 papers that she has put out there since the 70s, since she was a young adult. She's helped edit over 50 medical books and so on and so forth. It's outstanding, the work. So if you were to really drill down to the omega-6-3 ratio, you will come to one name, and that is Dr. Artemis Sinopoulos. She is now, you think that at her age that she'd be, I don't know, sitting back, taking it easy, maybe on the beach someplace in Florida or Arizona or someplace in Sonoma. No, she is still putting out there. For instance, did you know that she had the most popular downloaded paper in PubMed in the world in 2017, which means it was published in 2016. It became the most popular downloaded paper ever in 2017. That's amazing. And guess what? In 2021, which is the year that just passed, this is now mid-January, she had the record for the paper that was downloaded the most in the first 90-day period, which is what publishers keep track of. And I'm expecting at the end of 2021, when they tabulate all the downloads, that she will have been the most downloaded paper on PubMed for 2021. That's phenomenal. So let me give you a little bit of this. So the paper that was downloaded the most popular globally, we're talking about globally. So it's global relevance. People want to know about it. Doctors want to know about it. Hospitals want to know about how to do this thing, what she's talking about. It's a spoiler alert. I'm not going to tell you about the World Health Organization or UNESCO and how they're getting her. They want her work. That's for another conversation. But right now, that most popular paper for 2017, which was published in 2016, is an increase in omega-6 to 3 ratio increases risk for obesity. I hate to sort of put a plug for me in, but I did a couple of videos on this specific topic about inherent in COVID was the obesity comorbidity. And in that comorbidity, you had the highest, shall we say, bad outcomes. Okay, so there's more to come. So that was the most cited paper in 2017. All right, so the most cited paper for that first 90 days in 2021, which will probably be, and she was given an award for that one in 2017. She'll probably be given an award for the one in this one I'm going to tell you about in a second in 2021. And the name of that one was called The Need for Precision Nutrition, Genetic Variation and Resolution in COVID-19 Patients. That was the most downloaded paper ever in a 90-day period from publication. And that was put out in January 2021. That's why I think she has a really good chance of being the most downloaded paper ever. So this is for a woman. I don't feel I have the right to give away age, but she is at the peak of her career, the relevance of omega-6. So where do you get omega-6? If it sounds esoteric to you, it's not esoteric. If you are in the kitchen listening to me and you're putting it on your Alexa or whatever your listening system is, and you're listening to this podcast, and you're reaching for that corn oil, vegetable oil jug to cook in tonight, or the soy vegetable oil to cook in tonight, don't do that. How omega-6 got to be so high in the U.S. population today of 20 to 15 to 1, right? So it's 20 to 15 to 1. So 20 to 15 is the running average of omega-6 to omega-3, whereas 100 years ago it was 1-to-1, we've drifted very much into the high omega-6 range, which is linoleic acid. Where does that come from? It comes from those particular oils that are not just in what you're cooking at home. Should you cook at home? Do people cook at home anymore? I don't know. I hope so. But it comes from all the processed foods you have. Those potato chips you're having, they're very high in omega-6. Guarantee it. Those Doritos. You having Doritos? You love Doritos, right? That's your special treat at the end of the week because you work so hard. Screw yourself with omega-6. That's where it comes from. So all those processed foods, especially the chips and all the little treats, are very high in linoleic acid. Linoleic acid is omega-6, which converts into arachidonic acid, which converts into things that are very pro-inflammatory, which causes a lot of problems for a lot of people. I'll leave it at that general aspect. So my relationship with her is that I stalked her for a while asking if she would do an interview with me. So we talked for like an hour and a half once, unrecorded because she didn't want it recorded, just a conversation, just to be probably nice. We had a great conversation. Then she emailed me back, said, you know, we had a great conversation. I think I'll do that podcast with you. And so I wanted to add a whole nother layer is the reason I was after her, the reason I was stalking her is because she was an absolutely unique, historic character, a witness to how we got screwed through these nutritional guidelines that the U.S. developed, from Ansel Keys to those two bogus studies I've talked about on this podcast before and on YouTube that Christopher Ramson discovered and realized they didn't look at all the data. They came with the false conclusions, whether that was innocent or conspiratorial. It was the false conclusions upon which all of our nutritional guidelines were based upon all of Western Europe and Western cultures, as they say, were based. And so consequently, the negative consequences, the implications of misinformation are now 50 to 70 years in the generation of people who believe that, A, you should get down. You should drop the saturated fats in your diet to drop your cholesterol. And if you drop your cholesterol, you'll drop your chances of heart disease. Part A is true. You drop your saturated fats component of your diet, and you add in polyunsaturated, which was the corn oil and the soy oil and the canola oil and the whatever else, polyunsaturated to replace the saturated. Your cholesterol will drop down, but that is a very unhealthy aspect. So much so, actually, there's been papers written about papers, research studies, reviews written from Scandinavia, primarily in the early 1910, or early 2008 to 2012 began the period of what they call a cholesterol skeptics, a group of scientists said, I don't believe cholesterol is that big of a deal. And they produced papers and did studies and realized, you know, actually your cholesterol should go up as you get older because that's associated with all-cause mortality that goes down. So if you have an increase in LDL cholesterol, your chances of all-cause mortality go down, which is the opposite of the 1950s saying that drop saturated fats, get your cholesterol down because you don't want heart disease. And they came away from that whole Eisenhower era because he had four heart attacks while he was in office. Our hero of World War II didn't eat the right stuff, and he smoked. So this was a redoing of all of that. This is a 50 to 70 year project in the making. Also, she sent me recently, she's a witness to history as well as being a wealth of knowledge. I told you about a wealth of knowledge. So she sent me a study, and not a study. She sent me an article because she actually went to McGovern. So McGovern, Senator McGovern, in the 70s is the one that came up with the nutritional guidelines based on based on those two studies that Dr. Christopher Ramston revealed that were bogus, or rather misconcluded, shall we say, politely, euphemistically, and that you know, she was the one, you know, McGovern said, no, we're going to stamp out dietary goals for the United States should be based on these two studies. That's how they were going to do that. So she went to him and said, no, it shouldn't be. You can't have goals. We call them guidelines. And so she negotiated the movement from goals to guidelines. She is the person that did that. I love what she told me. I can't remember what conversation said it, and it might be in the recording that we have. She said, McGovern said, well, wait a minute. We know everything about pigs. We can make pigs fat. Why should we call this guidelines, and what's wrong with our goals? They can make pigs fat. There you go. That's a takeaway. Yeah, they learned how to add linoleic acid, soy, and corn to pigs and make them fat. And that was supposed to be the key to health. And that was the depth of understanding of McGovern. But anyway, she argued it back to you. It shouldn't be that. It shouldn't be goals. It should be guidelines, which was a Pyrrhic, I won't say it's a Pyrrhic victory. It was a win in the right direction. But at the same time, we suffered under 50 years of false information, given the false conclusions of those particular studies. So she is such a wonderful person to talk to. I so hope you enjoy this conversation. And I thought about maybe I should edit out all these different ahs and ums and so on and so forth. You got it in two parts. We talked for an hour and a half, probably until I exhausted her relentlessly. But so this is going to be the first part coming up, and then we'll have a second part next week. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you listen, and I hope you follow up, and I hope you look at these particular studies that I just referenced. They'll be in the show notes as well. Take care. Bye-bye.
For the Encyclopedia of UNESCO on omega-6, omega-3, omega-9.
Nice, nice.
Sources, metabolism, supplements.
Excellent.
And I am also emphasizing there what you should measure and why. And I think this is something that people do not understand.
Right, right. No, I agree.
Okay, so if you're ready, I am ready.
Yeah. Okay, let me get my little list of questions so I stay on an agenda, because it's so easy to just follow my whim, and that won't always be that constructive. So give me 2 seconds. Being organized is helpful. Well, good. I'm glad. I mean, there's so much here to cover, and I, you know, it just needs to be chipped away, and I think that this is so vital. You're kind of like, I hate to sort of say it this way, but you're kind of like the moon I was born under, in the sense of when I graduated from med school, you were all the rage. It was like, if you did nothing else, there you go. Look at this. And it got to be so loud that I go, is there anything else out there? You know, but now.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, it's actually right now, from what I gather, is extremely popular. The whole concept of the ratio. For example, just this week, I had 48 readings and citations out of a total of 400 something.
Wow.
And then you know, so I was getting something like over 400 per week. And about over 10% of that being citations and the other being readings.
Got you. So in your perspective, because in my view, you know, you have the history bar none. Why do you think there's this uptick now about your work, but about the topic in general?
I think the reason is that there is a great deal of work that is being carried out on the concept of lipid mediators that are actually metabolites of the omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids that are involved in inflammation. And those metabolites that come out of arachidonic acid, the omega-6,
right,
are pro-inflammatory, except one of them, lipoxin-4, where those that come, the metabolites from the omega-3 family, you know, alpha-linolenic acid, EPA and DHA are pro-resolving. And resolution is a dynamic process that is essential to life. Otherwise, it would be overwhelmed from inflammation.
Got you. You know, I wanted to sort of clear up that terminology, and I understand that how I came into it, and I'm sure you had that orientation as well. We talked about prostaglandins and kind of the family of prostaglandins that were formed from arachidonic acid as being, for the most part, pro-inflammatory, exactly like you said. And yeah. Then the prostaglandins that came from omega-3s, specifically DHA and EPA, were just the opposite. You know, and
they were less inflammatory, not entirely the opposite.
Okay.
They were less inflammatory. But now we have moved away one step further from the prostaglandins, leukotrienes, okay?
Right.
The eicosanoids. So we have moved away from eicosanoids to a further step, which is the lipid mediators, the resolvents
right.
and the protectants that are extremely important and very potent in the resolution of the tissues in the various diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And so much so that now even people like Charlie Serhan, my co-author,
mm-hmm.
who actually called me up and said, let's do the paper, 10 years ago did not have the data to believe that the lipid mediators from the omega-3 fatty acids, the maresins and the protectants and the resolvents
right.
are absolutely necessary for the resolution. And you can get more of them by eating more omega-3.
Gotcha.
So it took him 10 years to come around to that. And right now, this thing is so potent because the pharmaceutical industry now
right.
is looking at these proteins to develop drugs. Actually, they have synthesized some of these lipid mediators. But there is very good evidence, which actually I refer to in my paper on precision nutrition that I sent to you,
mm-hmm.
That very clearly shows that if you increase the EPA and DHA and also use some of the lipid mediators in cell culture, the cells will form more lipid mediators directly from the EPA and DHA. So we know that they come directly from there. And that's why right now the evidence is so strong, because they cannot argue.
No.
You
no.
see, that right. it is the amount and it is the ratio and it is how much.
Got you.
Which has nothing to do with the omega-3 index that I never refer to it.
Great.
Because if anything at all, the omega-3 index is a biomarker.
Right.
For increased risk to heart disease.
Right.
Because it's not the percentage, it's the actual amounts. Because there is enormous competition. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a calcium to phosphorus ratio.
Right.
Or a potassium to sodium ratio. In the body, there are substances that they've got to be in balance for normal metabolism. And this is what people are not taught, unfortunately.
Right. There's a balance.
Anyway, I was lucky that in 1976 and 77, I was at the NIH and I was in the intramural program. At that time, there were very few women. I think at the Heart Institute, where I was, there was only one other woman, and that was Brownwald's wife, who was at that time the director of the institute. And she was a cardiac surgeon. I was in the section of endocrinology and hypertension. And the chief was Fred Barta, who had studied with Fuller Albright at Mass General. And so I was learning my endocrinology from the guy who learned it from the founder of endocrinology. And we were working on various aspects of endocrine disorders that have a genetic component and how they relate to growth and development in children and hypertension in adults. And one of the substances that we were interested in at that time was prostaglandins, because Dr. Barta had described a syndrome called Barter syndrome that was associated with a metabolic alkalosis and hyperaldosteronism. And the idea was that maybe it had excessive amounts of prostaglandins. And so I was the only person at the NIH, plus Dr. Barta, who were interested in prostaglandins. And then at that time, there was interest in Italy at the Mario Negri Institute and with Galli in Milan on the nutritional aspects of prostaglandins. And so they had visited us at NIH and they gave a presentation and they showed exactly where prostaglandins come from, you know, and showed those that come from linoleic and those who come from alpha linolenic. And so I was just fascinated by it, because they pointed out that how much you get is how much you eat, because they were interested in the nutritional aspects of prostaglandins, where we were interested more in their metabolism. Anyway, they were the ones that were doing the original work on the nutritional aspects of prostaglandins.
Okay.
And because you had asked me the question or how I got into it.
Right, absolutely.
And so at that time, I began to look in great detail, because I wanted to understand the prostaglandin metabolism and fatty acids. And we were also following very closely the results of the Mr. Fit study, the multiple risk factor intervention trial that was funded by the Heart Institute, that in essence, it showed that cholesterol does not cause heart disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that by controlling dietary cholesterol, you don't really increase blood cholesterol most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there were all these issues that were questionable.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you know, Fredrickson was the director of NIH and he was very good in metabolism and asked me to take over the nutrition programs of the NIH, move from the Heart Institute and go and work with him in the office of the director at the NIH, because he also had left the Heart Institute and had become director of NIH at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, you're going to chair the Nutrition Coordinating Committee of the NIH, because we are in great need to shape up the programs. Otherwise, McGovern is going to take all the nutrition research outside of NIH, because Hegstead and the Harvard School of Public Health, they think that it should move to agriculture. So there was a political reason why they set up the Nutrition Coordinating Committee. And I, of course, at that time, I had to coordinate the activities of 14 institutes and centers.
Can't imagine.
But, well, It was not easy, but I got, but everybody got very excited about this whole issue. And they were willing. They were willing to help. And at that time, Dr. Leaf, who was the professor, chairman of prevention at Harvard Medical School and the chief at Mass General, called me up and said, what are you doing in the area of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids at the NIH? He knew I was pulling all the programs together.
Right.
And I said, I find out, I said, very exciting things. There are only 6 grants that NIH is funding, but it appears that fish and fish oils are anti-inflammatory and they have beneficial effects. And so he says to me, well, I agree with you, and I think we should set up a meeting to discuss all these issues. And so I presented all this to Fredrickson, the director of NIH, and he said, okay, just set up a meeting, but I want you to chair the meeting. I don't want Dr. Leaf from Harvard or Scott Grundy from Dallas, Texas, to chair the meetings. And of course, I was, to tell you the truth, I was a nervous wreck, because when I was a medical student in Boston, I took an elective in my fourth year at Mass General with Dr. Leaf. And we used to shake up every day he came in for rounds. Anyway, we set up the conference, and it was really, I would say, the most exciting conference that we were ever involved in, because we decided to look at the history as well as the medical and metabolic aspects of omega-3 fatty acids in seafoods. We decided we're going to leave the food industry and all the vegetable people out.
Nice.
And the reason we wanted to do that is we wanted to show exactly how many people around the world were involved in omega-3 research versus all the people that were involved with vegetable oils and cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the meeting was very successful. And one of the recommendations was to have a balanced omega-6, omega-3 ratio. And we gave the amounts for linoleic acid, you know, EPA, DHA, and we emphasized the ratio should be balanced, or 2-to-1, but not more than 3-to-4-to-1.
Wow.
And we also emphasized the need to have DHA in infant formula, which at that time did not have.
Okay.
So it was a very exciting times, because we touched a very important area that had been ignored.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but that's how it came about. There's always, you know, someone who comes and talks and makes a point, and somebody gets excited about it and things move.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful story. Very exciting. I mean, I share that excitement now. Years. What specifically, can you give me another date into there? Because I think the chronology is part of this whole story. Obviously, where we are today and the analysis.
So in essence, I would say it was in 1974, 75, I was interested. I began to show interest in prostaglandins, and then the conference then took place in 1985. Because in 1978, I moved from the Heart Institute in the office of the director, chaired the Nutrition Coordinating Committee, and we had to establish the whole program and show what kind of research NIH was funding. And it certainly was not epidemiologic studies. They were mostly studies, actually at the very basic level, that looked at the role of nutrients in gene expression, and all of this that neither, I think, Kegstead or the people at in the Department of Agriculture supported that research. Mm-hmm. We were doing fantastic research on molecular biology and gene expression. So by definition, any grant where a nutrient was a variable was considered nutritional research.
Okay. Okay.
And so from then on, we were very confident because at that time, McGovern was developing the dietary goals.
Absolutely.
And the dietary goals were such where once they finished their report, they rotated, they sent it to all the departments and expected comments because this was a congressional report.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I tell you, when I got it, I couldn't believe it because it was a report that never took into consideration that there are differences in the way people metabolize food.
Right. Of course. Back in
the
day.
And so I had to write the response to McGovern report for the Department of Health and Human Services. And actually, the response that I wrote was subsequently published in the Journal of the American Medical, the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, mm-hmm. at the time it was called. And I pointed out that you cannot have dietary goals. You cannot have the same goal for everybody because there are genetic differences. And there is no reason to restrict what a person does not need to be restricted to or from.
Right, right.
And the most we can do is to give dietary advice within which you would then consider if there are any special individuals with special needs. And so we actually developed the term dietary guidelines is what we recommended, and McGovern accepted it.
Got it.
And so he changed the name of the report from dietary goals to dietary guidelines.
Right.
I will send you that paper.
I'd love to have that.
You know, just for you to have it, to see what, in fact, a lot of the things we said then are true today.
I have no doubt. I want to frame this because some people are listening. They don't know how important what you've just said. I mean, it was such a critical time.
But I think, let me tell you, Carl, we were very lucky that Fredrickson was the director of the NIH because he was very strong scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a statesman. He had the support of the medical community. And he could go up on the hill and oppose the politicians.
Amazing.
Where today they don't do it.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And,
I agree.
And in fact, I tell you, he and I would go and I had to make a presentation to the McGovern committee. And I had to explain to him why genetic variation is important. Because he asked me, how come we know how to feed hogs and we don't know how to feed people?
Wow.
I said, you feed hogs for them to gain weight,
yep.
so you can make more money, get them to the market earlier.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But that's not what you want to do to humans, although some people are doing it, and that's why we have obesity.
Absolutely.
You need to have specific, anyway. So it's just to me, okay, you can have your definition.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And that was a victory of a sort. I just want to say that in my life, that was a pivotal time. You had, in essence, two reports going on, one in the United States and the other over in Australia, you know, and I'll keep collusion out of that, but they came to this incomplete decision. about saying drop the saturated fats and increase polyunsaturated, which means the vegetable oils, to be very general about that. And that was the better way to go because you needed to drop your cholesterol. This is kind of just mantra for all these people, you know, that know. But it was the dietary guidelines that were cemented that basically were a continuation of the Ansel Keys in the 50s saying, no, this is it. You know, the bad guy has cholesterol. And it wasn't until...
Yeah, they didn't want to change anything because you see what happened after the Second World War. There was a lot of technology that was developed for the Army and the Department of Defense. And that technology moved into agriculture. And so they began to have, destroy the small farms and have big farms owned by industry and then feed all the animals the same way. And they discovered that if they fed them grains, they gain weight faster and they can get to the market faster.
Yeah.
And so all the animals began to be grain fed. And at the same time, there was a lot of need for calories in Europe after the Second World War. And the biggest way and the best way they felt you could increase the calories and help the population get back on their feet by having more fat. And so they began to use enormous amounts of vegetable oils and then margarines full of trans made out of vegetable oils. And a lot of the meat of the animals who are under natural conditions, the animals graze, they don't eat grains.
Right, right.
An animal that grazes has EPA in its meat because grass has alpha-linolenic acid, which is the omega-3.
Mm-hmm.
And so by having the animals grain fed, you had high amounts of arachidonic acid. Mm-hmm. By using margarines made out of vegetable oils, you had high amounts of alpha-linolenic acid. Americans at that time did not eat fish.
Yeah.
I mean, even the Pope said, you don't need to eat fish on Fridays. And then you couldn't really find fish anywhere.
Right.
So we ended up... during the time of the McGovern Committee and the dietary goals, you also had in parallel in the Department of Agriculture changes in the composition of the food supply.
Mm-hmm.
So you ended up from a balanced omega-6, omega-3 ratio to huge amounts. And then from then on, you had the ultra-processed foods that are very high in omega-6 fatty acids. So you had a totally unbalanced ratio.
Absolutely.
And within the population then, in the biosynthesis of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids, you have genetic variants. So when you measure the arachidonic acid or the EPA in the blood is the result of what we eat and what the body synthesizes from the 18 carbon atoms, linoleic and alpha-linolenic.
Mm-hmm.
So at any one time you measure it, you have two sources for that.
Right.
And in any event, it was very obvious that from the Mr. Fit study that cholesterol does not necessarily cause heart disease. And at the same time, there were people changing the oils and using high amounts of vegetable oils like corn oil and sunflower oil,
mm-hmm.
and increasing this amount enormously. And they would lower the cholesterol, but they would not lower the death rate from heart disease.
Right.
That was the difference. And there were big arguments between the people in the U.S., particularly the guy from Minnesota.
The guy?
Keyes.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Keyes was
yeah.
from Minnesota.
Yeah, right.
And he was an epidemiologist.
Right.
And he did not believe in essential fatty acids. Where Hugh Sinclair at Oxford believed in essential fatty acids. Mm-hmm. If you go back in the literature in the Lancet in the 1957 and that era, you would see arguments back and forth. So Keyes was a very strong personality. And he believed that cholesterol caused heart disease. And so before the Second World War, he was ready to do a study to evaluate why the people in Crete had the lowest rate of heart disease and cancer and lived the longest. But the Second World War started and everything was put on hold. Mm-hmm. And it was not picked up again until in the late 50s,
wow,
when the Rockefeller Foundation had sent some representatives to Greece and went to check the people in Crete and found out they were in much better shape and they had less heart disease than the population in the United States. So the decision was made to set up the 7-country study. And originally it started with about, I think, 12. And then whenever the data were not what he expected, Keyes would eliminate data. And ended up with 7 countries.
It's called cherry picking.
Greece,
go ahead. Yes.
Greece, you know, Crete and Corfu.
Right.
And then the Yugoslavia, which was, you know, the Adriatic, mm-hmm, coast of Croatia today, mm-hmm, and then Italy and Holland, the United States, Japan, and Finland. And when they got all, and they did, you know, physical examinations, and they drew blood and measured the fats and sodium and potassium, blood pressures, etc. What they did was they began to look, I think they were very impressed that the Mediterranean countries, not only Greece, but the Mediterranean countries had less heart disease. And so they immediately jumped to the idea that it was the olive oil.
Right.
The olive oil, you know, does not contain cholesterol. And when you look at the data of the 7-country study, the people who had the lowest rate of heart disease and cancer was the people in Crete. But the people in Crete were the first, but the second, they were not the Italians or the Croatians along the Adriatic. Mm-hmm. They were the Japanese. And then the worst were the Finnish. And they had a tremendous high frequency of apolipoprotein E4. 24% of their population had that frequency. But they didn't bother with genetics. They didn't bother with essential fatty acids. And it was at this point that I decided that I was going to find out exactly what was in common between the Japanese and the Greeks, and also to find out what was going on genetically with the Finns.
Gotcha.
And I began then to evaluate the collection of their data, and I noticed there was a table that showed that the people in Crete had 3 times the amount of omega-3 fatty acids in their blood as the people in Holland, and half the amount of omega 6.
Wow.
So that really immediately made me think back of the prostaglandins and omega 3s and everything, and I pulled everything together. And I decided I was going to look in detail what was the composition and where were they getting these high amounts of alpha-linolenic acid, because olive oil has just a little bit.
Right, right.
And then I did all the studies and I found out that all the green leafy vegetables are very good sources. And at that time, people looked at plants only in terms of fiber.
Right.
I remember when we published the article in the New England Journal, and we said that it was a very good source of alpha-linolenic acid, people were shocked. And then I moved on from the plants into the meat. And at that time, in all the animals in Crete were grazing. They were not animals that were grain-fed. And then I looked at the composition of the egg. In fact, we brought the eggs to NIH. We hard-boiled them in Greece and brought them. And we did the analysis at the clinical center. Norm Salem and I did all those studies.
Wow.
And then we looked at the cheese and we looked at the milk and we looked at even at the snails.
Yeah.
Because in Greece they eat a lot of snails.
Yeah.
And they have omega-3s, and they have more omega-3s than the snails, the escargot in France.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the whole picture was obvious that there was a balanced ratio and a high amount and practically no omega-6. Whereas in Italy, they had omega-6 because they were growing sunflower as a cheap source. And then, of course, we went and examined carefully what was going on in Japan. And the Japanese eat a lot of fish.
Yeah, of course.
So what was the common factor between the Japanese and the people in Crete? It was a balanced ratio of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids, which in Japan, the omega-3s came mostly from fish and fish oils. Whereas in Crete came throughout the food supply. In other words, every meal the people ate in Crete, it contained omega-3s. The eggs contained omega-3s. Their vegetables contained omega-3s. Their meat contained omega-3s. Everything contained omega-3s. And that's why I think it's important. And the reason, if you're going to do a study, you need to supplement every day, and eating fish 2-3 times a week is not the answer. Because in those countries and the way we evolved, it was on a daily basis that you had a balance.
Right. Right. You can't pancake.
So this is the chronology and the evolution of the whole thing.
That's a fascinating chronology, and I love hearing it. So when we talk about omega-3s in the context you talked about and looking at analyzing those foods, okay, on the veggies, we'll call it the green leafy vegetables, we get ALA. And from the animals, we get primarily, you know, the meats and the fish and the snails.
Okay. Let me tell you, maybe I should start. There are two families of essential fatty acids.
Yep.
Linoleic and the parent fatty acid. And alpha-linolenic acid, which is the parent fatty acid for the omega-3s. Okay. The omega, the LA then is metabolized to arachidonic acid. And the alpha-linolenic acid metabolized to EPA. Then the arachidonic acid becomes the parent fatty acid for the production of eicosanoids. And the EPA becomes the fatty acid, the parent fatty acid, for the production of eicosanoids from the omega-3 family. And there is a question whether you can go from alpha-linolenic to EPA. I mean, that's very clear. Whenever you eat flaxseed, you're going to increase your EPA, for example. But how much DPA is formed Now, some it depends. You can have a significant amount of DPA because in many animals, you in the carcass, you find out that they have DPA. But you don't go directly from EPA to DPA to DHA. There is a question whether you can actually go from alpha-linolenic acid to DHA. Because there is a question of one of the enzymes, the question of beta oxidation. Anyway, you form a small amount
right.
of DHA. You have to get DHA directly from the fish.
Okay. So just to put a little finer point on that.
Because, okay, now I'm listening to your question. Yeah.
Okay, because in the context that I've sort of lived in and patient and all and everything, it comes down to you have those who are very vegetarian, we'll call them, you know, plant-based, and those that are a little more open and they're mixed. And then, of course, then you have those that are very animal-based, be it poultry, fish, and meat. And so in the, it's been sort of an artificial justification that I've always heard through these last couple of decades that, oh, well, wait a minute, I get plenty of omega-3 from my veggies because. But the reality is, yeah, you do, but you don't convert very well. And, you know, it's better than nothing, but it's nothing like the EPA and DHA that you get from fish and or animals.
Yeah, let me tell you, you get enough EPA, but you don't get enough of the DHA unless you have you're a fast metabolizer, in which case you're going to get more DHA than those who are not fast metabolizers.
Got it.
So that's why it's very important, not just to take a dietary history, but to measure all these types of fatty acids, whether from omega-6 or omega-3, mm-hmm. to measure them in the red cell membrane phospholipids, mm-hmm. because that is what circulates in our bodies. And they are found on every single cell membrane in the body. And this amount is what you get from eating plus what your body synthesizes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that is a very important concept because if they just get a dietary history and they don't measure it at baseline, and then they give supplements, and then you get all kinds of positive and negative results.
Right.
It's because it's very important to know exactly how much of the omega-6 and omega-3 and what type is in the body. Mm-hmm. And then once you give EPA and DHA, what is the increase? Because as you know, Carl, there is so much omega-6 that giving 1 gram of EPA and DHA is not enough. You have to give at least 4 grams. And some of the early studies done 30 years ago, they were with higher amounts and they got very good responses. Now, the Icosapent, they used 4 grams of EPA in a pharmaceutical form. But the studies that were done at the Peter Ben Brigham, following a heart attack, they gave 4 grams of EPA and DHA, and they were able to show a much faster recovery after the first myocardial infarction, less fibrosis, and a better function of the heart.
Nice.
Therefore, the whole concept of having adequate amounts and a balance is essential in the management of all the diseases we're dealing with.
Yeah. And you can throw in psychological disorders as well. But yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, so, depression, did you know?
Yeah.
There are now very good studies with fish oils and depression that they showed that P450, which is the enzyme mm-hmm. Involved in the metabolism of EPA and DHA, is very important in treating depression because there are some people with depression that they are in a very pro-inflammatory state. and they need higher amounts of the EPA and DHA.
That's right. And maybe it's not as black and white, but schizophrenia and to a degree autism's, you know, in the wings of that particular concern as well. In other words, the EPA DHA ratio, not ratio, but amount.
Yeah. Yep. So let me tell you, ideally then you should draw blood, get the red cell membrane phospholipids, mm-hmm. and you should measure all of them. You should measure the linoleic acid, and you should measure the alpha linolenic acid, and see what the ratio of those two are.
Right.
Because their metabolism depends on their amounts. Then you should measure arachidonic acid, and then you should measure EPA and DHA, and measure the ratio of arachidonic acid to EPA and DHA. And in order to get an anti-inflammatory response, or in order to get resolution, mm-hmm. you need to have a ratio which is either balanced, or it is much higher in EPA and DHA, because, you know, you don't know how long the person has had the disease and on right. and on and on.
Right.
So you really need to have, you go from you want a balance to about much higher, 4-to-1. One that is 4 times the EPA and DHA versus the arachidonic acid. You want a much higher amount. And the way to understand this is to look at some of these studies and look whatever data are reported. Mm-hmm. But not the omega-3 index. The omega-3 index is not appropriate except as a biomarker, as a risk for heart disease. For all other diseases, you need to measure the red cell membrane phospholipids of both omega-6 and omega-3s.
Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp again. For a brief reminder of something I completely forget to do at the end of every episode. You've heard me talk long enough and many different episodes, but what I would love you to do, and many of you have already done this, I just want to reinforce this particular behavior, which is to send me your questions. Send me your questions and anything you have about keto. If there's something that I don't know, I will look it up. And if it's something that intrigues me, I will probably make an episode, a podcast about that particular topic. So what you need to do is to send me your questions at drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. So that's drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. Feel free to join our Facebook group, which is also ketonaturopath.com. That's been growing lately. You also have to answer a questionnaire should you choose to join. And I don't ask for your email. I ask that you follow our terms. I try to avoid advertising and the obvious interruptions of just a good Facebook group. So hope to see you at one place or other. Please send me your questions and look forward to talking to you and getting to know you. Take care.